Welcome to Ask an Atheist. Happy Halloween week. My name is Becky Friedman, and with me in the studio today are Josh and Meredith. How are you guys doing this week?
Doing pretty good.
I am doing great. My favorite holiday is coming up.
So the Halloween is your favorite holiday?
It is.
And what costume have you chosen this year?
A unicorn.
Nice. Okay.
Wes and I are actually both unicorns this year.
Beautiful. So what's the horn made from? Is it like an upside down ice cream cone?
No,
is it
it's just felt wrapped and stuffed with a stuffing.
And what are your designated colors? Are you going full on Lisa Frank with all of the purples and the pinks and the blues and the turquoise?
Yeah. Mine's all purple and pink. Wes is all black and green and purple.
Nice. Josh, Halloween costumes?
Yeah, I'm going cheap, so I went with Mr. Robot. So, you know, the Money-Wise character, or I can't remember the exact character's name, but the mask that they use is like their anonymous alternative.
And
then a black hoodie.
Nice. Okay.
Simple.
I'm going in full teachery, kid-friendly style as Arthur the Aardvark. So
that is so perfect.
which is really, if you think about it, really just something that I would wear on a given, you know, day. It's kind of this little yellow sweater, and a pair of blue jeans, little red sneakers,
a button down.
Yeah, it's like, if you just have the ears alone, like with the thing, you're Arthur, and if you take the ears off, suddenly you're Kimmy Schmidt. So it's those kinds of fun ones. I'm still hoping for someone to be my Francine or Muffy or DW. We'll see, because we still got 2 more days till Halloween up here. So I actually really like Halloween also. I like kind of the fun costuming things. Maybe it's the teacher part of me. In high school, I really didn't like these spirit weeks and pep rallies and things, but I go all out for the homecoming spirit weeks, and then Halloween just follows up 2 weeks later and it's another excuse for it all.
Yeah, I've always been really into costumes and cosplay and crafting.
You know what I really like about costumes is that you can be super creative, and you know, what I don't like about costumes though is that some people take them as a sign of, you know, I don't know, consent to comment on parts of your body or touch parts of your body.
Right.
So just remember, this Halloween, a costume is not consent. You know, someone who would have been able to really take some good out of that advice is the forever maligned Bill O'Reilly.
Oh God, why have you forsaken thou?
So this was a very strange thing, because I've not really heard Bill O'Reilly being overtly religious. He doesn't tend to pop into the news as someone who is, blaming hurricanes and earthquakes on, you know, pride parades and things like that. In my personal opinion, he seems to be awful for completely other reasons usually, but not on the religious, you know, grounds. He doesn't seem to want to, you know, institute a theocracy like some dominionists do with the United States and things like that.
I don't think he's against a theocracy. I mean, he just wants it to be a Catholic theocracy.
Okay.
I
mean, so we've got a little Vatican.
Not like an active proponent of it, is he?
He's not an active proponent of it, but he would basically welcome the handmaids, the handmaid's tale.
Okay.
Open arms. He would be a part of that revolution.
Blessed be the fruit.
And I feel very, very sorry for whoever would be the off bill, but here's why Bill O'Reilly is coming into our purview at Ask an Atheist, where you can call us at 844-SKEPTIC and email us your comments or questions at questions@askanatheist.tv. But here's really where it comes into our purview, because on a recent episode of his web series, No Spin News, Bill O'Reilly blamed God for the blowback surrounding sexual harassment accusations against him, lamenting that he wished that he had had more protection and that this stuff hadn't happened. The stuff that he wishes hadn't happened or didn't happen is the revelation from the New York Times that he paid out a $32 million sexual harassment settlement to a former colleague at Fox News, in addition to 5 other settlements totaling $13 million. O'Reilly has vehemently denied the accusations and claims he only settled with his accusers to protect his innocent children from being unfairly punished. So let me get this straight, Bill. You say, okay, I didn't actually sexually harass these women, but I'm going to pay them exorbitant sums to save my children the embarrassment of having a, I don't know, sexually harassing father or something like that. And then you say it didn't actually harass these women. And really, God should have protected me from all of this criticism.
He prayed so hard and God didn't answer them.
Yeah, no, it's completely amazing. I mean, he thinks that the crime is actual it coming up instead of actually what he did.
Oh, the hard thing is oh, that people are criticizing him.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what he thinks is the problem, that all of a sudden his dirty deeds came to light, not that he actually is a horrible human being.
And you don't spend $45 million if there's no there.
I'm aghast that he would then say, I mean, for someone that's a horrible person that, you know, has a pattern of apparently sexually harassing women and colleagues, you know, you could say, oh, I am so sad. I am so heartbroken that suddenly all of this is now coming to light, especially when you pay an exorbitant sum to try and keep it quiet. Hush, hush.
Right.
Well, oh, sorry. To try and spare your children the embarrassment. But okay, let's say what it really is. When you try and pay $45 million to say, don't pay attention to this, we don't want it getting out, and then it gets out, I can understand you being a little bit ticked off, but then to blame it at God's feet? That's really a weird angle you're taking on that one. I mean, if I were a believer in God, I would find that to be reprehensible. As someone who's an atheist, I find that just to be bizarre. You can't take responsibility for your actions, and then you wish that because you're so immature that God had then protected you from your own immaturity and horribleness?
It kind of smells of a prosperity belief. Like, he believes that he attained his position, so he must be a good person. So now he's wondering why God is no longer protecting him. Because apparently God's been protecting him this whole time.
Hmm.
Was there any God protecting the woman that he sexually harassed and had non-consensual sexual contact with?
And sent gay pornography videos?
She obviously didn't have God's favor because she had to sue to get the $32 million.
Well, one could say that she started praying enough and then following prosperity gospel philosophy, right? That's all your prosperous, you know, abundance coming to you is that $32 million. But no, I mean, that whether you're a Catholic like Bill O'Reilly or a believer in prosperity gospel has very little intersection, I believe, with whether you treat your colleagues or people that are above you or you know, under your work hierarchy in a respectable manner and in a respected manner.
Well, and to treat women in a respected manner.
Well, you know, Bill O'Reilly is a really articulate guy with all of his, you know, things that the stuff, he just wishes that stuff hadn't happened, you know, changing an entire woman's career path based on whether she has sex with you or not. That's just some stuff over to the side, right?
Yeah.
And if you pray hard enough to God and if you call yourself a Catholic, Mr. O'Reilly, you should be protected from that stuff of, you know, the desire of one of your colleagues, a female colleague, to be able to work in an environment unmolested, right? So, I mean, Bill O'Reilly, really, you got to take responsibility for this at some point. You can't lay it at God's feet. You can't just, you know, make it go away with your money, with your $45 million, you know, to a series of women. It's at your feet right now. I mean, everybody has seen the back footage of Bill O'Reilly being very abusive towards the camera operators and the production crew, I think.
Yeah.
Because he didn't understand how something worked.
Right, exactly.
When he started out at the O'Reilly Factor, coming from what, Current Affairs?
Yeah, and you know, I'll paraphrase, when he just kept stumbling over himself and then, you know, said, forget this, we'll do it live, right? And that's sort of that thank goodness for YouTube and you know, old back clips, right, coming to light. You know, it's not surprising that he, you know, is horrible and abusive to his production team in general. So I don't know that it would be completely surprising to find out that he's treated women in a very, you know, derogatory and an awful way. But don't try and get out of it by saying, oh, God should have protected me on this. That's the most ridiculous, palest little reach that you've ever, I think, I don't know, ever, because I've tended to stay away from looking at Bill O'Reilly. I mean, he's off Fox News, right? That's why it's former colleague.
But I mean, he's in talks, supposedly, as of last week. I don't know if it's changed the status,
oh,
but
that's right.
Sinclair Group might be actually putting on his show.
So we have these people who are doing really reprehensible things and patterns of those reprehensible things being given purchase by major media groups.
Essentially being shuffled off like priests in a way.
Ooh, sort of within. So it could be similar to within the Catholic thing of, you weren't good in this place. We'll just go send you to a different diocese or a different place over
here. Commercial application of Catholicism.
Oh, my goodness.
Yay.
It's a really astute kind of observation there with those. Man, you know, there's something I hate to say even worse in this intersection of mistreatment of women and religion and politics and government. Let's head all the way across the pond to Portugal. Are you guys ready for this one? Because I gotta be prepared. I gotta be steel myself for this one.
All right, I'm ready.
Okay, so a Portugal man who viciously attacked his ex-wife with a nail-spiked club was not sentenced to any jail time by a judge who claims that the beating was biblically justified. In his ruling, Judge Joaquim Neto de Moura defended the man's behavior, arguing his actions were excusable because the woman's infidelity had dishonored him. He additionally cited passages from the Bible that the adulterous woman must be punished by death. So groups such as Amnesty International Portugal have been swift to condemn the ruling, calling it abusive, discriminatory, and misogynistic. So I guess, guys, does this mean that according to this judge, since the Bible said that adulterers should be put to death, since he only beat her with a spiked mace, that, you know, oh, he was merciful? Like, what is going on here?
I mean, this is the same as culture. I mean, Christians here in this country call Islam for honor killings. This is an honor beating. I mean, that was on the verge of being an honor killing in the name of Christianity. I mean, it's the same thing that they criticize other religions for. Beliefs matter is what it comes down to.
And when you use something, a scriptural doctrine that's part of your belief to then justify horrible behavior?
Yeah, that's not okay. How did this happen in a court setting?
I don't understand.
And how, like, religiously intertwined is the church and state in Portugal, where a ruling like this could fly?
There's definitely a culture of Catholicism within the whole Iberian Peninsula, but you're supposed to have impartial judges in the same way that you have judges being impartial on other things of finances or, you know, other types of assaults or, you know, vehicular, you know, accidents and things like that. You got to have impartiality. I would say that if you're using biblical scripture to then try and justify your own rulings, you're going by Bible, not by your case law and your body of legal documentation of your country.
Yeah, I don't know enough about or anything about Portugal law. So I mean, I don't know if they have a separation of church and state like we do somewhat. And I mean, it proximity to Spain, both countries are pretty religious from what I understand.
Both countries, in terms of historically being joined, right? You had the entire Iberian Peninsula that, 500 years ago was really intent on kicking out the North African Moorish Muslims to then be able to establish La Reconquista, right? The reconquest under the Christian crown, under the Catholic crown,
Isabella,
right?
Isabella and Fernando.
Yes, exactly. But Portugal did manage to remain separate, its own separate identity, which is why today we have, a whole country united under one language of Portuguese and an entire country, Spain, united under Castilian Spanish. Footnote, go take a look at what's happening in Catalonia, right? Yeah. So you do have some historical separation between Portugal and Spain, right? But you do at the same time also have the Catholic crown that is influencing, if not laws directly in a modern time, influencing cultural acceptance of the way things should be. Parts of Europe all kinds of parts of Europe that are governed by a historical church, whether it's Church of England or Church of Norway or the Catholic Spanish crown, you have these conflicts between what the church doctrine says and then coming into the modern age of, you know, allowing same-sex marriage, liberalizing your abortion restrictions, legalizing divorce. And I don't think that Portugal is any stranger to that kind of conflict. It's just really irksome and upsetting when you see someone then holding and cleaving to this biblical law to try and support, you know, and justify and excuse a vicious beating of a woman.
It's domestic violence. It's saying that the Bible says it's okay to beat your wife.
And in fact, it does.
It does.
But it
and
doesn't.
It says the adulterous woman.
Well, yes, I mean, it does.
And this is why, you know, we haven't said it, I think, in a long while. But if you've been a longtime listener of Ask an Atheist, you've heard Sam over and over again saying people are better than their books. You know, when you have your holy book saying that an adulterous woman shall be put to death, then people will say, you know what? I think that's a little extreme. You know, people end up being better than whatever their doctrine, their scripture, you know, supposedly requires of them, because we don't like to hurt and kill humans. We don't like to hurt and kill each other that we feel an affinity with. And I think that when we can, as humanists, feel affinity to a greater number of people outside of our tribe, outside of our folk group, outside of who looks like us or who speaks the same language as us, we just expand the lines of who's within our in-group, who's within our circle, to all of humanity. You say, we feel that affinity with you, and we're not going to want to use a piece of scripture to justify, you know, keeping you as an outcast, ostracizing you, beating you, killing you, making you have fewer rights than another group. And I think that even if there's people who don't identify with secular humanism, they may still identify with a God belief. There can definitely be humanistic qualities to those that are better than their books, that say, no, we think that this ruling is not justified by the Bible. We don't think that you're allowed to beat your ex-wife just because, you know, the Bible says that someone who cheats on you should be put to death.
But that is always there. The option is always there, as long as there's some kind of stipulation to where they believe that they need to pull from these ancient texts.
It's so true. So I think from the U.S. to Portugal, we're going to hop around again to a place where it was amazing, guys. At an economic summit in the Middle East, a woman was front and center on the stage. She received her own time for speaking time. She didn't have to cover her head in any kind of way. She didn't wear an abaya or a hijab or any kind of headscarf of any kind. She was up on stage at this economic summit without a male guardian or a male chaperone.
Wow.
It's pretty amazing. And
that's incredible.
Of all places, it was Saudi Arabia. So do you guys want to hear about this particular story? Because this is kind of a really interesting, you know, foot forward in what I saw. And here it goes. The Saudi government has apparently granted citizenship to a robot dubbed Sophia, a humanoid machine with female features who holds conversations and makes facial expressions. Wait, guys, you tricked me.
Oh, no.
Oh, man. Real human women in Saudi Arabia were only recently granted driving privileges and still must be accompanied by male chaperones in most circumstances. Women must receive permission from male guardians to travel, obtain higher education, or engage in basic banking, and must adhere to strict modesty dress codes. Debuting at a Riyadh economic summit, though, Sophia the robot reportedly declared that she was, quote, very honored and proud for the unique distinction of being the first robot in the world to be recognized with citizenship. Sophia appeared on stage without a male chaperone and wore no head coverings. Guys, what's going on?
I'm flabbergasted. I mean, there's no way, first of all, this robot can't even pass a Turing test. So it still doesn't even come up to any kind of dilemma about intelligence and artificial intelligence. And the fact that they just want to give this robot rights that they won't even give their own citizens.
So you have an entire swath of the population that doesn't have half the rights that the other half does, and someone who is faker and less human than a real woman is suddenly granted more rights.
I want to see if she's able to drive.
So insulting.
Is this, oh, is this the combination of self-driving cars? Like in the,
a self-driving Sophia?
I guess.
Honestly, I think they're actually opening the door for the new push of sex robots coming from Japan.
Ah, really? Into
Saudi Arabia?
In Saudi Arabia. I think that's going to become a thing. And they're just...
That's a very provocative hypothesis and prediction, Josh. So we've got, but do you think that those will be granted any kind of citizenship rights or the right to consent to, because once you start once you start granting citizenship rights and personhood status to female robots, and then you have robots that are then used for recreational purposes, if you will, are those robots going to have more rights to refuse sexual contact with their husbands than, or with their paramours, if you will, than actual real life Saudi women have? Are they going to have more rights than that? Because right now in Saudi Arabia, a woman is not permitted to refuse sexual contact to her legally wed husband, as is the case in many countries around the world, and not just ones that are Muslim dominated. I mean, it wasn't until pretty recently in the United States in the last, you know, few decades that spousal rape became a thing that was actually prosecutable. In terms of that, you know, recreational pleasure robots from Japan being imported into Saudi Arabia, where then do you see this, Josh, as being able to maybe push rights for real human women?
I'm gonna go back to the Handmaid's Tale, and it basically this is gonna be for their pleasure, and then wives are just gonna be considered for breeding.
Oh my
goodness. I have to say the implications of giving a robot citizenship over women is just like insulting and staggering.
It might be just a ploy. It just reeks of like they just want to get headlines or something. And they wanted to.
But if she can be a citizen, like what else can she do? Can she vote? As a robot? Can she vote? Can she buy property?
Do all citizens have, or you know, if she is a she robot that's a citizen, does she still need permission to open a banking account? I mean, she was at an economic summit, so I don't know. I mean, who then controls her banking? Is her creator then the male chaperone, the male guardian that gets to approve all of these things?
Who knows? I would like to know one thing. Probably the reason she wasn't wearing a head covering was because she has no hair.
Oh, so as long as you don't have any hair, then you can't be considered immodest because you don't have your, you know, sexy flowing locks. I'm not buying it, Meredith. I think that this is like
awful.
A ploy for saying, look how forward thinking we are in terms of robotics and technology in, an economic powerhouse like Riyadh.
I'm pretty sure somebody will find her LED scalp erotic. In some kind of form.
Someone somewhere will have
some new kind of fetish.
Repressed
light up
nation.
Skulls.
Well, this is Ask an Atheist. We'll be back after the break. 844 Skeptic, Josh, Meredith. I think we're going to hop somewhere else in the world. Robot free. Free of head coverings or no head coverings.
Radio Tacoma?
Radio Tacoma.
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 Tacoma. KTAHLP 101.9 FM.
Hello, and welcome back to Ask an Atheist. I'm Becky Friedman, and Josh and Meredith are with me in the studio today, and we were just in Saudi Arabia. But let's hop back to, let's see, Europe. Do you guys want to talk a little bit about Halloween? Unicorn, Mr. Robot, Arthur from PBS Kids. But did you know that Halloween actually brings kids to Satan?
Well, obviously.
So, Northern Ireland's Diocese of Derry and Raphoe has warned in this week's annual synod that the cult of Halloween is highly dangerous and could expose children to the principalities and powers of Satan. Reverend David Crooks addressed clergy members at the gathering, saying that Halloween is turning into ridiculous, horrible nonsense, and warned that witchcraft-related accoutrements found in commercial decor can lead children to start looking at the internet.
Oh no, not the internet.
And finding their things like tarot cards and seances, which he characterized as, quote, highly dangerous stuff. Here's that stuff again. of these gentlemen need to be a little bit more articulate than just stuff.
Stuff is so scary.
Thankfully, it's better than, you know, the stuff that Bill O'Reilly is referring to. But this highly dangerous stuff, seances, tarot cards. Josh, I mean, you never touched those things when you were a kid, right? And so you don't have any principalities of the devil.
I absolutely touch these things as a kid, so I am a principality of the devil.
Yeah, I was going to say, Halloween's my favorite holiday, and I'm a Satanist, so they might be right, actually.
I kind of agree in I don't like tarot cards and stuff like this, because to me, it reeks of cons. I mean, these are instruments of conning people. I mean, it's fun when you go to a party and it's just something that somebody does.
Wait, isn't it just the devil and Satan conning you and tempting you? Oh, wait, that's not the kind of con you're talking about.
No, I'm talking about financial fraud by seemingly nice people, but really just there to...
What? Hucksters?
Hucksters.
Okay. Charlatans, hucksters, con men, con women sometimes. It's many times women that will be into the cultures of fortune telling and tarot cards and things like that. Sort of weirdly
occult stuff.
Weirdly gendered stereotyped roles for the being agents of the occult and magic and things like that. So, what do you guys make of this? I mean, did a Ouija board turn you into an agent of Satan, Josh?
No, I did that myself.
Okay. And, you know, Meredith, you just claim to be a Satanist.
I mean, I'm a member of the Satanic Temple, so it is technicality.
Which means, like, what at this point? I mean, it means you dress up like unicorns at Halloween parties?
Yeah, it just means I'm a member of the Satanic Temple, and it doesn't mean anything in particular.
Well, I mean, you're not really part of, you know, the Church of Ireland, right?
No.
And so in terms of what the horrible principalities of Satan are possibly, like, we've talked about the Satanic Temple in general, and the Seattle chapter, you know, does things like marches in the Women's March after the Trump election or Trump inauguration. Marches in March for Science.
They do a lot of activism. They do a lot of work, you know, bringing light to issues. And right now they're doing a Men Straighten for Satan campaign. collecting.
You're going to have to figure out or enlighten me on that one. Because
collecting feminine hygiene products to donate to women in need who don't have access to
that
them.
Sounds so nefarious.
So basic community service projects and making sure that people can exist with their own bodily autonomy.
Good for other humans, yeah.
So what the heck do these priests in Northern Ireland have against all of that? Or is this a different kind of Satan that they're thinking?
It's the other Satan, I think. The scary one that sends you to hell where you burn into flames.
Yeah, it's their boogeyman. I mean, essentially, I mean, they do this every year. There's nothing new. They just have to have their boogeyman to push their agenda. And, I mean, we did it. We experienced it in the 1980s and 1990s with the Satanic Panic.
Don't play with your He-Man toys and your troll dolls because it will teach you to be Satanists.
Yeah, Skeletor
like
is obviously, I mean, from hell. I mean, there's no ifs, ands, or buts about that.
So speaking actually of Skeletor and skeletons and Halloween kinds of things, there's an observance that is close to my heart because I am a Spanish teacher, and it oftentimes gets conflated with Halloween, and it's Mexican Day of the Dead or Día de los Muertos. And I had posed a question because it's, you know, I teach about it in our classroom, understanding and pointing out that it's the syncretic observances between what was pre-Hispanic, pre-Columbian of the peoples of what's now Oaxaca, Mexico. So some of the Aztec communities and the communities that the Aztecs subsumed. And also then this Catholic influence, you know, putting them together. So you have imagery of crosses and you have, you know, graveyards and Latin and Spanish prayers and things like that, but in a very, you know, native Mexican way that honors the traditions of, you know, 1,000 years with, you know, marigold flowers and lots of skeleton imagery and things like that. And I thought about it and I said, okay, well, since it is such a mix of different religious practices, but at its heart, a family observance where you have families that are cleaning graves and then decorating them and then having a full-on party, right? You have all night, you stay up all night, and you drink the drinks, and you eat the favorite foods of your ancestors that had died. You know, you make mole and chocolate and hot chocolate, and you're there with guitars and instruments and boomboxes, and there's dances, and it's just a really neat family time. And I thought, you know, in much the same way that in the United States, Christmas often becomes a secular observance where you have friends and family just convening to spend time with each other, I wondered, does Dia de los Muertos for some Mexicans who are atheists have a secular way of being observed? Is there a way to have that observed when you are still an atheist? And so I actually went to the Facebook group of the Secular Latino Alliance. It's a Facebook group, and it's pretty neat to, you know, for folks that, you know, might have a shared heritage or shared experiences of folks living mostly in the United States who are atheists, but might have a lot of this like background of, you know, a lot of these Catholic observances or, you know, things like that. It's a neat place to congregate online, at least, and sort of discuss and work through some of those issues. So I posed that question. I said, does anybody, you know, celebrate Dia de los Muertos in a secular way now that you're an atheist? And I got some really kind of cool responses. So the first was from Tomas from California. Do one of you guys want to share what Tomas had said?
Tomas says, never heard of it till I moved to California. Even then, not for at least 10 to 15 years after.
So what this actually speaks of, which is really cool, is that, you know, Dia de los Muertos is definitely not even celebrated throughout all of Mexico. And it's in, you know, the Oaxaca region, and you have people in the United States and Mexican American and Chicano communities that then pay homage to their heritage in Mexico, and you end up having Dia de los Muertos celebrations in a lot of our big cities. So from Austin to San Antonio to Sacramento to LA, Albuquerque, and, you know, even here in Tacoma and in Seattle, you have some of the cultural centers, so like Centro de la Raza up in Seattle, that does a Dia de los Muertos exhibit every year. And the Tacoma Art Museum has focused on Dia de los Muertos and Day of the Dead. So it's kind of that weird thing where it's exported from a part of Mexico to then, within this Mexican diaspora, be even more celebrated or acknowledged. So
similar to Cinco de Mayo.
Yeah, so Cinco de Mayo definitely is a bigger deal for Mexicans in the United States than it is for the people of Puebla. Puebla is one of the smallest states, if not the smallest state, I think, in Mexico, and celebrates one little battle where they basically had this ragtag bunch of folks that were able to say, no, French people, go away. So while Tomas hadn't really heard of it until then being in California, there's a lot of people that had celebrated it, so or had that experience with it. So Mariana actually had a disagreement about whether it could be secular. Josh, you want to tell us what Mariana thinks about it?
Honestly, I don't see how it can be secular at all. I celebrate like crazy. It's actually my favorite holiday season of the year. And even though I don't pray or something, the celebration is religious. We celebrate that our beloved ones return from the dead to party. It's kind of rough filter the ancient religious meaning. I mean, one can prefer doing it the least Catholic possible, but ancient pagan religions are still religious, and I'm going to add a sick to that.
You've got that acknowledgement of, like, maybe I want to reject this Catholic part of it, but at the heart of it, you're still acknowledging that even if it's pagan, even if it's part of the indigenous belief systems, that's still part of a supernaturalistic belief system, thinking that you're, you know, the dead, right, can come back.
I mean, yes, but also I think it's very artistic. I love the art of it, like the iconography, and I mean, it's a beautiful celebration if you ever get to see anything. I'm going to see it someday, but just the floats that they do, and it's all really skeleton based, and I'm trying to think, I believe it's the Book of Life actually uses the same artwork. That's very,
yeah. So the Book of Life was a kids movie, and then Coco is coming out now, and sort of normalizing that mythology into pop culture, right? Normalizing of, like, this is what it's all about. I would say that kind of has this double double-edged sword, if you will, because it then allows people to have more exposure to it and understand it and say, hey, not all skeleton imagery is scary and gory and gross. Some of it's really beautiful, and the skeleton is what's left behind after, you know, somebody's died. But at the same time, you have people, the opportunity for misunderstanding or taking a very surface level approach to something that is, you know, a really complex holiday, right? And even if you don't believe in the supernatural part of it, there's, you know, the possibility to misunderstand it and, you know, make weird assumptions about how, you know, Mexican people believe and celebrate this kind of thing, or think that all Mexican people believe like this and celebrate this. You know, the capital of Mexico, DF, the federal district, didn't have that big parade for Dia de los Muertos until the James Bond movie popularized it.
Oh.
Oh, wow. So that's really recent.
Exactly. So that didn't exist in the capital of Mexico. It was relegated to a different region of Mexico. But now it's sort of become part of Mexican national identity.
That's really interesting.
In life imitating art, imitating life imitating art, in its imitating death, I guess.
Inception.
Yeah. Louis from California had something else to say because he wasn't really familiar with it initially. Meredith, what did Louis say?
I started checking it out because I was curious. It is a part of my culture, and my city had some pretty cool activities organized around Dia de los Muertos.
On the other hand, Arlene shared with us,
I don't usually celebrate Dia de los Muertos, but if my abuelita or mom would invite me to the cemetery to have a picnic to celebrate a deceased loved one, I would not say no. Dia de los Muertos is silly, but it's also part of my culture. I'm not about to turn my back onto my culture, and I really apologize for chewing up Spanish.
I think what Arlene's talking about really is, like, you do it for your family, and I think that's something that a lot of secular individuals or atheist individuals can relate to.
Yeah.
Because you might not have something where you celebrate, you know, midnight mass at Christmas.
No.
But maybe your family does, and you enjoy spending time with your family more than you hate singing at midnight mass.
Right. You go because it's part of that tradition with your family.
And you can ignore the magic stuff or choose not to go if it's really that bothersome. My problem is just I don't like the concept of ancestral worship. I think that's kind of, especially as a white guy, can get very messy.
So actually, Jorge from California spoke exactly of ancestor worship. It's strange because oftentimes we hear things of ancestor worship associated with some of the animist cultures of East Asia or in majority Buddhist countries as well. But we don't often hear about it in terms of the Mesoamerican and Central American places. So Meredith, tell us about what Jorge sees it as.
I take it as a form of ancestral worship. Sometimes some atheists are so uptight with their disbelief. So I got to explain myself because I will get flooded with angry comments. That's a real problem on Facebook, I hear ya. I am an anti-theist. Ancestral worship, as in honoring those in your family who came before you, you can take it in a literal or metaphorical sense. I'm happy I do celebrate because death sucks, and the death of those that I lost is even worse for me.
So you hate the ancestral worship kind of thing, Josh, but Jorge says, like, no, I got it. And you might be one of those uptight atheists. You're so uptight in your disbelief. What's the problem with honoring those who come before you, Josh?
No, honor those that come before you that are worthy of honor. But also understand that your family tree probably has some bad apples that you should have no obligation at all to honor.
And finally, Anna actually says we can still honor our dead and not have to have religious tones. So yes, I still honor the holiday. And I think that really shows the diversity of how secular individuals then interface with culture and the religions that are often, and the religious practices that are often associated with the different cultures. So if you guys had the opportunity to go to Oaxaca and experience or participate in Dia de los Muertos, would you take that opportunity?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
I definitely would.
You don't have to buy into an ideology to admire the beauty of any kind of art.
I think, Josh, as much as Jorge might call you an uptight atheist, I think that you've proved that you're a little open-minded. Even atheists can be open-minded, even if we do subscribe to Satan's wily ways. This is Ask an Atheist. We'll be back after the break.
You are listening to KTAH LP 101.9 FM, Radio Tacoma. If you'd like to help us out or learn more, go to radiotacoma.org. Specifically, if you're hearing this, we'd love to hear where you are and how you found this.
Hello and welcome back to Ask an Atheist. 844-SKEPTIC is our voicemail line. You can call us and leave a voicemail. We'll play it on the air. You can also email us, get questions at askanatheist.tv. There's some up-and-coming things. I know that we're just talking about Halloween, but hey, the winter solstice season approaches.
It's approaching in retail, too.
Oh, it is. But non-commercially, completely without retail regards, Humanists of Washington and Seattle Atheists and the University Unitarian Humanists are having the annual winter solstice potluck celebration. It's in approach of the solstice. So it's actually going to be December 9th, 2017 at 5 p.m. And it's at the University Unitarian Church in Seattle. That's at 6556 35th Avenue Northeast. And just as last year, we're encouraging attendees to bring new socks to donate to Treehouse. And that's an organization benefiting foster youth in the greater Seattle area. In my work as a teacher, I actually work directly with students who benefit from Treehouse. So it's a good organization. And we're looking for new socks, you know, nothing with, you know, the little sweat stains on it and the little holes and nubbies on it. So it can be really nice. And, you know, adult sizes, because, hey, teenagers are foster kids too. And children are welcome and essential part of any kind of celebration, and this is no exception. We'll have some craft activities for them, and we welcome teens who want to help facilitate and assist with that also. So again, that is December 9th at University Unitarian Church, 5 p.m. in Seattle. And a bunch of the Ask an Atheist crew will be up there also, usually. And it's a fun time, and it's a Saturday night. So, you know, not a school night. Don't have to worry about all those kinds of things. And hopefully it's a little bit before some of the company holiday parties and other kinds of stuff get really, really busy. Right?
Right.
Yeah, I can't wait until we initiate our war on Christmas.
Oh, right. Because that's all that atheists do, you know, with celebrating with potlucks and making snowman arts and crafts.
Destroy.
Because we're celebrating a solstice.
Right. So, let's see. We've got an email, actually, from Brandon from Hawaii. And Brandon writes, "Thank you for all the time and effort that goes into the show. Becky has done a great job on the show, but my family misses Sam and hopes that he is well." Aww.
I agree. You have done a great job, Becky.
Well, thank you. Thank you, guys. You guys make it easy here behind the console. Sam will be back and joining us soon here and there. He's actually, in last week's episode, was behind the scenes doing some production. And we should be hearing Sam's voice sooner rather than later. I know that he's been taking a lot of time, well-deserved time off. But he's got some awesome other projects. You can actually see kind of stuff that he's up to by going to patreon.com/Sam Mulvey if you want to support Sam and some of his other kinds of projects as well, besides Ask an Atheist with Sam Mulvey. So, guys, we've kind of been bopping all around the world, right? We've been to Portugal, we've been to Saudi Arabia, we've been to Northern Ireland, we've been to Mexico. Where do you guys want to go next?
I think we need to go next to Down Under.
So let's go to New Zealand, where New Zealand recently swore in their new Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, one of the few politicians right now to speak openly about mental health issues, citing her own personal struggle with anxiety disorder. A strong supporter of liberalizing abortion law and LGBTQ rights, Ardern was unanimously elected by New Zealand Labour Party colleagues to fill the vacancy left by former leader Andrew Little's stepping down. The 37-year-old former Mormon, who was listed in her senior class yearbook as most likely to become prime minister, took the oath of office without the customary utterance of, "So help me God."
Strong women are awesome.
Yeah, strong women who don't really need God to help them with their governing policies. I mean, you know, Bill O'Reilly earlier in the hour who, you know, needed God to protect him from people criticizing him for being a sexual harasser. Yeah, have someone who's, you know, 37 years old who struggles openly with her own anxiety and saying, no, I don't need God's help to help me, like, you know,
become prime minister of New Zealand.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure she is more likely to be able to take self-responsibility over instead of trying to plead to God why anything goes wrong. So I have high hopes.
I do too, and it's really neat. You know, we're still looking next door to Australia that has just completed their plebiscite vote. We referred to that last week when we talked with Shelley, who is, you know, Aussie expat. And, you know, before the deadline to vote, which was October 27th, right, the votes were overwhelmingly in favor, but we did have, you know, a nasty campaign going on, you know, basically using sensationalist headlines to say that, you know, gay people are unfit to be wed and, you know, be parents and things like that. When right over in New Zealand, you have the prime minister who's a supporter of LGBT rights, and New Zealand who has been, you know, legalizing marriage equality for before the U.S. had marriage equality. So I think Australia, you got some competition here, you know. So we wish Ms. Ardern best of luck. And I think that there's some really cool things to be coming out of just having someone who is that young and someone who is that different in how she speaks of politics and political issues is a really neat thing. And then on top of it, to just say, yes, I grew up Mormon, but I'm not going to invoke God to help me with my leadership, is something that's really, really wonderful in terms of being a role model for young women who exist without God and the supernatural.
Yeah, that's really cool to see. It makes me happy.
So Maryland, I think, is where you spent some of your time, Josh, right?
Yeah, unfortunately.
I think we're going to be taking a long flight all the way back to the U.S., real close to our capital, right? So Maryland, the Fourth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals has ruled 2-1 that a 90-year-old cross-shaped World War I memorial in Maryland is unconstitutional. Judges ruled that the Peace Cross, which is maintained by public funds, has the primary effect of endorsing religion and excessively entangles the government in religion. The monument is part of a larger memorial park in the immediate area honoring veterans of several wars and contains some secular symbols and quotes. But the court still determined that the sectarian elements easily overwhelmed the secular ones and noted that it was by far the most prominent monument in the area, conspicuously displayed at a busy intersection. Meanwhile, Governor Terry Hogan criticized the ruling as outrageous overreach, and his spokeswoman told reporters that all options, legal or otherwise, are being considered. Wait, what, guys? Otherwise? You have a governor, a spokeswoman saying we're considering
otherwise?
Yeah, what
legal.
Are you going to do? Oh, no.
So I'm hoping here, Governor Hogan and your spokeswoman, that you're talking about maybe merely social pressure, right? Nothing illegal, overtly illegal options that are being considered. But even that, to say like, oh, if they had just said we're going to use the court system to the full extent that we can and help file appeals, that would have been one thing. But to say legal or otherwise, if you're talking about social pressure against, atheists and humanists who want to maintain a separation of church and state, and religious folks that want to maintain a separation of church and state, you are not the governor of all of your constituents, sir.
Right. That's not good. So how big is this cross exactly?
It's 40 feet tall.
That's a big cross.
Oh, no. That is prominent.
So I believe it was something like 50. This is commemorating 50 soldiers specifically from World War I. And basically, I mean, it's assuming that all those soldiers were Christian. And then everybody else that's viewing this is Christian and has no problem with Christian being the only religion ever portrayed for a World War I memorial.
Well, and it's clearly the only way to memorialize dead soldiers, right? Is with a big cross.
Well, yeah. A torture device. Absolutely. I mean, what a better way to actually commemorate somebody that sacrificed.
Well, I mean, you know, apparently for the folks that wanted to keep this erected and said, no, it's just, it's, you know, there's non-sectarian elements of it. Just merely having the word valor stamped across it is enough to tone down the fact that it's a 40-foot cross.
Valor.
Yeah, valor. So
that's the secular word.
Yep. Okay. Well, there's a quote also from Woodrow Wilson. So, you know, I mean, that should be enough to, you know, downplay the 40-foot cross. That's apparently the only and best way to memorialize dead soldiers, because all dead soldiers need to be memorialized with a 40-foot cross.
Jesus.
So, you know, we had a little bit of funny interaction with this, because it was actually the American Humanist Association that brought the initial suit back in 2015. And with one of the other organizations we work with, which is Humanists of Washington, putting on that solstice dinner. We actually, Humanists of Washington, sometimes people get confused between Washington, D.C. and Washington State. And there were a few little notes put on you know, our social media and sent to our email about, you know, like, don't interfere with, you know, trying to take down public monuments and things like that. So, you know, just so you know, just you might want to look and see that not everything that says humanist in it is the American Humanist Association. And trust that the American Humanist Association, when it has a lawsuit, it sometimes will lose those lawsuits, but it's using the legal system to the full extent to say, hey, let's examine this and see if it does violate the Constitution. And in this case, it was found to violate that Constitution. I mean, when you have hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, being spent to maintain a big Christian symbol, it's you know, two out of three of them rule that this is excessive entanglement of the religion, you know, with the government.
And because of the intent, it clearly is.
So one thing that caught my eye actually was the dissenting opinion. So the dissenting judge said, well, it's been up for 50 years without any kind of problem or without any complaint. And this irks the heck out of me, because it's like saying, well, as long as something stands for a long time, even if it was unconstitutional to begin with, then we should just be fine with it, because merely because the thing itself is old.
Yeah. And this is the same argument that's been about the Confederate statues that need to come down. Absolutely. I mean, unless it's Robert Lee with the only Confederate flag that matters, which is a white one. But other than that, I mean, they need to come down. They're a part of bad history trying to glorify the worst nature of America.
So that argument that, well, it's been up for so long, that doesn't indemnify it suddenly from either social criticism or from its constitutionality or non-constitutionality. Right. And I really wish that in the realm of these religious symbols, that people would understand that merely because it's been around a long time isn't a good enough argument to say that something is just merely ceremonial and doesn't have any religious meaning to it. I mean, we talked about this a few weeks ago when you talk about, you know, under God and the pledge, or in God we trust as the motto, or, you know, stamped on our money. When you say it's old, it's been around long enough, you know, then it becomes ceremonial. That argument is used over and over again. And luckily in this case, it was in the minority dissenting opinion, but You have people saying, well, you know, what's the big deal if somebody right now says, let's hold graduation ceremony in a church hall? And you say, well, it doesn't really matter. Well, if you have those things that are not, you know, nipped in the bud right away, then it risks becoming one of those things that is been around a long time,
like
thereby giving
a 40-foot cross.
Yeah. Like a 40-foot cross.
I really just wanted you to do that again.
And then also, I mean, if to this about a graduation ceremony in a church, Jehovah's Witnesses infamously don't enter churches. And so
churches other than their own kingdom halls, right? And even observant people of other denominations don't. I mean, I remember being told by my grandparents, like, you don't set foot in a mosque or a church. That's someone else's house of worship. And by you setting foot in there, you're
no longer clean.
Right. So
are unclean.
So it's forcing people to, you know, I would say that would be a good application of RFRA, of religious freedom restoration, of saying you're unfairly burdening someone's religious practice by making them participate in stepping into someone's church. I mean, now I just, even when I was, observant Jew, a place is a place, right? You make it holy or not by whatever you do in it.
Well, you don't really make it holy, but
well, okay, but that was my
they think they make it yeah. holy.
That was my that,
yes,
you
right.
sanctify it by coming together and doing your prayers there, whether it's in the middle of a synagogue
it's,
or
know,
a field,
feeling, not a physical place.
Right,
it's the act of being together.
Right, right, exactly. So I would really hope that we can keep an eye on and keep an ear out for more tirades from Governor Hogan, and hope that someone can redirect his spokeswoman to realize that considering those legal options or otherwise is probably maybe not the best thing you want to be speaking for in terms of on behalf of your governor.
I'm actually kind of happy too, because in today's judicial climate, for something that actual be decided in a correct direction is a little heartening to me.
I think that that's a really good point. And when we see, when you see judges and political leaders and our attorney general, you know, questioning the separation of church and state and why that's a good thing or why it's not a good thing. I mean, separation of church and state protects religious minorities as much as it protects atheists and humanists. Mm-hmm. It protects maybe someone who is right now in the religious majority who may not find themselves in the religious majority later on. And I think that that's a really important thing to remember. Well, Josh and Meredith, thank you for joining me today on Ask an Atheist. You can email us at questions@askanatheist.tv. Find us at askanatheist.tv. Give us a voicemail at 844-SKEPTIC. You can tweet us at AskAnAtheistWA and find us on Facebook. Josh, Meredith, happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween.
We'll see you guys next week.